Do you have it with you?
No, it's at home. I read it before I go to bed.
Okay, you don't have it online.
No, I read it on a hard copy.
All right, who does that? Okay, well, one reason to mention it is that it is in dactylic hexameter, which we talked about a little, and which Longfellow was experimenting with. Did people get a chance to look at and print out what I sent on Latte? Okay, so if you didn't, how did I guess that would be the case? I'm not sure I have a copy. Yep. Here you go. I should have split it in half. Okay, so what... did you get a chance to look at it?
Yes.
All right. I like the tone of that. Yes. No, I know you did because you actually emailed me about it because I screwed up, so thank you. So the first thing on the poem is the first thing on the file that I sent you, the doc I sent you, is the Ashbery poem, The Wrong Kind of Insurance, which we talked about a little bit last time as thinking about where lines end. And so this is the whole poem as it appeared in The New Yorker. That's what the 31 on the top of the page. It was page 31. I think this was 1977 that it came out. If you were taking a modern or a postmodern American poetry class, Ashbery is almost certainly one of the poets, thank you, that you would do. And we could spend a lot of time on this poem, but what I want to do, just to give you a little bit of a sense of Ashbery, we got a bunch of stuff to do soon. Also, you have a paper due a week from Thursday, if you've been looking at the syllabus, and I will tell you more about that on Thursday. I will also remind you that we do not have class on Tuesday, because it's Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so just going through this briefly, I'm going to read it aloud to you. It's fine. One way to read Ashbery, one way to be with Ashbery, is just to let yourself float in his language. It takes a while to get used to it, but here it's just a question of feeling where his language loosens and where it tightens. And the thing about Ashbery is people who love him, and very few people love him when they first read him, but lots of people fall in love with him over time. People who love him partly love him for the intense moments that will surface in his poetry. So his poetry is kind of often will sound just like the buzz of discourse that we have in our oral universes, in the soundscapes in which we live. But sometimes that buzz will just become more noticeable, will stand out, become more prominent, and then you'll find breathtaking lines in Ashbery. But remember, we looked at the beginning of his Fantasia on the Nut Brown Maid, and that begins with the balladic line, "Be it right or wrong, these men among," and then it becomes much more prosaic. "Be it right or wrong, these men among others in the park are a plain kind of thing," and becomes prosaic, or his word would be plain. But then the end of that beginning is, "I from your thought to the green wood go, alone, a banished man." And what you get is, to quote James Merrill again, a net of loose talk tightening into verse. So that experience of things tightening into verse, you get that in Ashbery. So I picked this poem at random last time just to give you a sense of what would make something a poem if we are thinking of line endings as crucial to poetry. And in Ashbery, you don't much hear where the line endings are if he were reading it aloud, unless he were to pause. Gently, do you need this? You didn't print it out. Don't worry, no one did. To hear where the line endings are. But maybe a way of describing what I'm saying here is that sometimes you can. So in Ashbery, you usually can't, but then sometimes you can. And that's when, in the rhythm, let's say, of background thought, which is what Ashbery, in a way, is articulating, the kind of language, words, possible sentences, possible phrases that are going through our heads all the time, sometimes they start becoming prominent, tightening, as I say, standing out. And you can hear that, mentally hear it, in his poetry. So just to read this aloud, we're not going to spend much time on it afterwards, but just to get a sense of that. I teach in a high school and see the nurses in some of the hospitals. And if all teachers are like that, maybe I can give you a buzz someday. Maybe we can get together for lunch or coffee or something. The white marble statues in the auditorium are colder to the touch than the rain that falls past the post office inscription about rain or snow or gloom of night. Do people know what that is, that post office? Can you pass this down? Thank you. Do people know what he's talking about there? The post office inscription about rain or snow or gloom of night? No one does? Do you all know Laurie Anderson? Do you know who she is? Oh dear, how time changes. Do you know who Lou Reed is? Okay, so Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed were a couple. When he died, they were together. She is one of the great experimental musicians of the current day and of the last couple of decades of the 20th century, maybe most famous for Oh Superman. Anyhow, she sings that line as well. It's inscribed on the post office in New York City, and it's neither rain nor snow nor heat nor gloom of night.
I know it's like, will not stop us from delivering your thing, essentially.
Essentially, but not exactly, yeah. Neither rain nor snow nor heat nor gloom of night shall stop these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. So does that ring a bell with anyone? Mm-hmm. Ring half a bell? Okay. It's like you type bell and the bell actually shows up in your text, but you say, nah, it's not going to ring the bell that much, so you type the word bell. Okay. The white marble statues in the auditorium are colder to the touch than the rain that falls past the post office inscription about rain or snow or gloom of night. So notice how that tightens a little bit about rain or snow or gloom of night. What rhythm is that? Rain, about rain or snow or gloom of night. Da 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 da. What's your go-to for English rhythms? Not for what a single word is, but what a standard English rhythm is. Iambic, yeah. Yeah, but it's prose in the post office also. It's not a quotation from poetry. So, but it's what English tends to tighten into. So then the rain that falls past the post office inscription about rain or snow or gloom of night. I think about what these archaic meanings mean that unfurl like a rope ladder down through history to fall at our feet like crocuses. All of our lives is a rebus of little wooden animals painted shy, terrific colors, magnificent and horrible, close together. People know what a rebus is? Mm-hmm. What is it?
It's like one of those weird word puzzle thingies where there's a word you're looking to make, and they'll give you like two images, or it'll be like a play, a literal play on words, where a word will be like in between two other parts of a word.
Yeah,
it's hard to explain, but.
Yeah, they used to be, it's like candy used to have them, or comic books sometimes had them, or newspaper comic pages had them. It's where, it's basically a pun on pictures. So you have a bunch of pictures, but if you put them together, you get a word or a phrase. I'm just trying to think if I can make up a rebus at random. Which I probably can't. Like the word night, let's just say you were doing gloom of night, or that just that line, or gloom of night. What you might have is some iron ore, a picture of iron ore, if you can imagine that, which I'm not sure I can, but a picture of iron ore, and that would be the word ore. Then the letter G. So a picture of iron ore plus the letter G plus a picture of a loom that someone might be weaving on plus of plus a picture of what? You can do this one.
A knight.
A knight. Yeah, maybe a chess piece knight. So that's a rebus. It's when you have a bunch of pictures and they come together to form a familiar phrase of some sort. Okay, is this stuff you've seen at some point? So he says, all of our lives is a rebus of little wooden animals painted shy, terrific colors, magnificent and horrible close together. The message is learned the way light at the edge of a beach in autumn is learned. So that's a good line. Don't worry about what it means, but just because a whole lot of poetry is being struck by a line before you quite know what it means, but thinking this is worth thinking about. The way light at the edge of a beach in autumn is learned. The seasons are superimposed. In New York, we have winter in August as they do in Argentina and Australia. Spring is leafy and cold, autumn pale and dry, and changes built up forever like birds released into the light of an August sky. Falling away forever, to define the handful of things we know for sure, followed by musical evenings. Yes, friends, these clouds, pulled along on invisible ropes, are, as you have guessed, merely stage machinery. And the funny thing is, it knows we know about it and still wants us to go on believing in what it so unskillfully imitates, and wants to be loved not for that, but for itself. The murky atmosphere of a park, tattered foliage, wise old tree trunks, rainbow, tissue paper, wadded clouds down near where the perspective intersects the sunset. So we may know we too are somehow impossible, formed of so many different things, too many to make sense to anybody. So notice that's like a rebus, formed of so many different things, too many to make sense to anybody. We're just formed of all these different things. We struggle on as quotients. What's a quotient? Yeah, it's like 3/4 or 7/13, which is to say that they're not being simplified into a single number. It's not like 10/5, which is 2, but no, we struggle on as quotients. Hard to combine ingredients, and what continues does so with our preparation and consent. Try milk of tears. But it is not the same. Another beautiful line, I think. And don't worry if you don't quite get it. Usually what English professors say is, don't just think it's a beautiful line and be impressionistic about it, but figure out what it means. But with Ashbery, it's not clear that that's the best way into Ashbery. So just let that be a beautiful line if it is one for you. Try milk of tears. But it is not the same. The dandelions will have to know why. And your comic dirge routine will be lost on the unfolding sheaves of the wind. A lucky one, though it will carry you too far to some manageable, cold, open shore of sorrows you expected to reach, then leave behind. So that's where we're going to end up. Often in Ashbery, the ends of his poems will come together in a way where the meanings are more vivid, more lucid. So, yeah, we all expect, especially at your age, to reach some manageable, cold, open shore of sorrows which you'll leave behind, stuff you'll go through. But maybe you don't leave it behind. That's what he's discovering here in this poem. Thus, friend, this distilled, dispersed musk of moving around, the product of leaf after transparent leaf, of too many comings and goings, visitors at all hours. Each night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. So that's how it ends. Again, I think that's a beautiful line and a half. Each night is trifoliate, strange to the touch.
What's trifoliate?
Anyone?
Three-leaved.
Three leaves, like a three-leaved clover or poison ivy, although I don't think he's thinking of poison ivy. But it means that it has three leaves. So leaf after transparent leaf, that's what we've gone through in life. But then there's night, and often his poems end with night. He has another wonderful poem that ends, "The summer demands and takes away too much, but night, the reserved, the reticent, gives back more than it takes." So again, Ashbery is amazingly suggestive, and we're not going to spend much time on him in this course. This may be the last Ashbery we do, in fact. But what I wanted to point out to you here is how it gets into a rhythm at the end. Too many comings and goings, visitors at all hours each, and then night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. So do you hear that? Each, it's not iambic, it's each. Night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. So do you hear that as rhythmical? Night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. So what that is dactylic. Night is tri, da, da, da. Each night is trifoliate, da, da, da. Strange to the, da, da, da. And then touch. Lots of times dactyls just end with a single stressed word. So each night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. And now I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think that's part of the opaque, obscure, mysterious power of those last lines, if you feel their power. I think if you do read Ashbery, and most people don't, and most people who do stop, but if you do read Ashbery and get into Ashbery, a way to read him, a way to get into him, is just to notice the lines that are standing out, that are mysterious, that are somehow drawing you in, and noticing just how beautiful some of those lines are and how often they appear at the ends of his poems. So each night is trifoliate, strange to the touch. That's what night is, trifoliate, strange to the touch. So we won't interpret that any further, but when I picked this poem, as I say, just randomly in the last class, it was because it's a poem that you can't tell where the line endings are on the basis of beat, whereas you can with a limerick, right? There was a young man from Nantucket who's... So where does the first line end?
There was a man from Nantucket.
Yeah, you're hearing it. There was a young man from Nantucket. There was a young man from Calais. So you hear where the ends of the lines are, and that's what you hear in oral poetry. In a sense, it's what you hear in certain kinds of rap. That is, that what you hear are essentially, you could say, that each rhyme is a line ending. It depends how you define a line. But the rhymes there are very, very prominent. And then if you shift into a new set of rhymes, you also know what it would look like if you went to Lyric Genius or whatever it is, and you were looking up the words. You would see that they were short lines and that the rhymes were coming in a kind of staccato mode, and those rhymes were clearly line endings. You wouldn't think that there was a line which had one word that had been rhymed 8 or 10 times already, and then another totally different word that didn't rhyme with it at all, but that's opening up another set of rhymes. You wouldn't put those in the same line. So you can hear that. You can hear limericks. You can hear ballads. There are lots of line endings that it's really easy to hear. And what's particularly easy to hear are rhymes as line endings. But you can hear in There Was a Young Man from Nantucket, or There Once Was a Man in Calais, or There Was a Young Lady Named Bright. Anyone know how that goes? Do you know any limericks? Do people know limericks? Someone recite a limerick. Does anyone know a limerick by heart? Do you just not want to say because it's too dirty? Or do you know one? It looked like your hand was going up. Okay, this is a physics limerick. There was a young lady named Bright who could travel faster than light. She went out one day in a relative way and returned the previous night, because she went faster than light. So she goes backwards in time, right? Are you finding it painful, that one? All right.
It's not the worst.
It's not the worst, no. All right, so there was a young lady named Bright who could travel faster than light. She went out one day in a relative way and returned the previous night. You already know There Was a Young Lady Named Bright, that's the end of the line. You don't have to know what it's going to rhyme with. In other words, you don't need the rhyme to know the line ending. So the examples we were giving in ballads and the like were examples where it seems like you do need to know the rhyme to know that it's the end of a line. But the onset rhyme, so let's talk about, there actually turns out not to be a technical term for this as far as I can tell, and I've been looking for a long time. But we can talk about when you have two rhymed lines, you can talk about the first rhyming word as the onset rhyme and the second one as the resolving rhyme. So if someone says, there was a young lady named Bright, then you are going to be waiting for the resolution that will come with the word light, who could travel faster than light. So you hear the onset, you wait for the resolution. Roses are red, violets are blue. Now you're waiting for the rhyme with blue. And the rest of that, the experience of waiting for that rhyme is, well, an experience of waiting, of expectation. Something is set up, a tension is produced that will be resolved when the rhyme comes. So we can hear onset rhymes. We don't need to know or hear what the word rhymes with to know that this is the word that something is going to rhyme with. So that's why you sometimes get jokes where you're expecting a rhyme, but you don't get one. His lyrics, this is the end of a limerick. His lyrics were terse and often good voice. His lyrics were terse and often good verse, but marred by occasional anticlimaxes. So what's the joke there? Yeah, and it's not rhyming with anything. So obviously anticlimaxes isn't rhyming with the first two lines of that limerick. It's self-picturing self-defeat. This is the bad limerick version of after great pain a formal feeling comes. marred by occasional anticlimaxes. Okay, so there are various ways of hearing that we are at the end of a line, and the fact that we can hear it without a rhyme is a true fact, because otherwise we wouldn't know what word to expect will be rhymed. If we didn't know we were at the end of a line, we wouldn't know what word we're listening to rhyme the end of that line. So you may think, yeah, rhymes are easy. They tell you line endings, no problem. But without rhymes, you don't really know. But the truth is, even with rhymes, you have to be able, even if you don't know how you're doing it, it's just part of what we've internalized by learning language. Even if you don't know how you're doing it, you are doing it. You know where we've come to the word that will be rhymed. And the fact that we can do that means that we're doing it through meter rather than through rhyme. We all have metrical intuitions. If you know poems or songs or any sort of tightened form in a rhyming language like English. As I said before, ancient Greek is not a rhyming language because it's too easy to rhyme, so rhyme is actually considered a mistake. Ancient Latin is not a rhyming language. But Chinese is a rhyming language. Modern English is a rhyming language. German is, Russian is. So it depends on the language. There's some languages where it's too hard to rhyme and they don't rhyme, and there's some languages where it's too easy to rhyme, and poetry in those languages tend not to rhyme. But if you hit the sweet spot, then poetry does tend to rhyme, and English is one language that hits the sweet spot. So if you know songs or poems or nursery rhymes or anything in English, you will also know where to expect the rhyme to come. Where the first line ends, the onset line ends, so that the resolving line will be dictated by the onset line. And again, you may not think that's true, but it is. So one of the things we're trying to do in this class is just get further consciousness of that. Is your hand up? No. Okay, because you were hearing rhyme. I scratch my ear because it's rhyme I
hear.
All right.
It was so hard.
I know, but see? Nevertheless, a little work and you can do it. Okay, so one of the things then that we were talking about, so here we're in a situation where we were talking about oral kinds of poetry, like ballads, like blank verse. Someone define blank verse again?
No punctuation at the end of lines?
No, it can have punctuation, but it's no rhymes at the end of lines is essentially it. But good blank verse of the kind that Milton writes will almost never have punctuation at the end of lines. Although Evangeline does. Yeah. It doesn't rhyme.
Sometimes, but it's always midline. It's like strike, and then the next line I'll say something. You know what I mean? Like he strikes, and the next line, like in the middle, it rhymes.
Yeah. Okay. So he'll play with rhyme, but rhyme is not a structuring feature of Evangeline. But Evangeline does tend to be end stopped. It does tend to have punctuation at the end of the line. So that's not the issue. But in iambic pentameter, it's boring if every sentence is 10 syllables long. That gets boring very quickly. So it tends to be the case that in good iambic pentameter, you will have, what's it called when it's not end stopped? Anyone remember?
Feminine?
No, feminine is just when you have one extra unstressed syllable. But when you don't have a period, a comma, a question mark, a semicolon, a dash, or anything like that at the end of a line. Enjambment, which literally means to step over into the next line. It's remember that lines are made up of feet. And the idea is that you are walking across a line. Each foot is one footstep. And when you get to the end of a line, if you enjamb, you are just stepping over into the next line. Your leg is reaching out into the next line, and you're not breaking your rhythm. So if it's not end-stopped, it's called enjambed. And blank verse tends to be enjambed. It isn't always, but it tends to be enjambed. Okay, so what we've been talking about, just to sum up briefly, is that if you say that a line defines poetry, that's easy to see with printed poetry. One of the things you may have been told, or you may know, if you're quoting poetry when in a paper that you write, is that you have to respect line endings. That if you quote a poem, then you have to put the line endings, you have to indicate, either by indenting, so that you have a chunk of the poem laid out on the page the same way it was laid out in the original. If you take a Shakespeare class and you are quoting "to be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer, etc.," you have to end the lines where the text that you're quoting, where Shakespeare did. So it's "to be or not to be, that," and you don't say, "oh, I'm out of space, so I go to the next line," is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind. You know, that might be totally fine format for prose. And when you're quoting prose, you don't pay any attention to the line endings of the book you're quoting from. But in poetry, you do. So it's "to be or not to be." Tell me if you know where the line endings are. "To be or not to," just tell me when we hit a line ending. "To be or not to be, that is the question." Okay. "Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms." Okay, you gave up on that.
"Whether
'tis nobler in the mind to suffer." Okay. "The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles."
Of troubles, actually.
Yeah, and by opposing end them. Okay, so you don't have to be precise or precisely conscious when you're hearing iambic pentameter of where the line endings are, but there is something in them that has an effect on how you were feeling, the emotion, the passion, the meaning. Okay, so there are line endings in oral poetry, and those line endings, remember, Milton recited his poems, Homer recited his poems, those line endings exist even if the poems are never written down. In the same way that ballad line endings existed before ballads were written down. They existed because they rhymed. So there are endings that exist even when they're not written down. On the other hand, there's something like the wrong kind of insurance, where you couldn't possibly tell where the line endings were unless you were looking at the poem on the page. So there are line endings that are visual and line endings that are auditory. I won't quite say they're audible, as I won't say they're quite visible, but it's close enough. So they're auditory line endings, they're visual line endings. Most of the time, they coincide in ways that are not an issue. If you look at a ballad, like some of the ballads we were looking at, "Proud Maisie is in the Wood," line ending, "Walking so rarely," "Sweet Robin sits on the bush, singing so rarely." You can hear the line endings and you can see them on the page. "Tell me, thou bonny bird, when shall I marry me, when six broad gentlemen kirkward shall carry ye." You can both see and hear them. But sometimes it doesn't work that way. And in particular, it tends not to work that way if we are looking at a poem that can only be visual in its line endings. So flip the Ashbery thing that I handed out. And here are two poems by E. Cummings, both untitled. So look at the top one. No, sorry, that's what the dash is doing. That's what the break is doing there. It's two poems. It would have been easier if he titled them, but he does, but these are untitled poems. So, anyone understand the first one? Yeah, Masu.
I, a leaf falls, loneliness.
Where'd you get the L for loneliness?
It's like you have to apply it both here and here.
Wait, what?
There's an L in, like, the middle.
Yeah.
Between one and enus, but it wouldn't make sense to say one old enus, and I noticed that you could use the L to form loneliness. Oh.
You, some people, I swear. Have you read, did you read the poem, etc.? Mm-hmm. That's a dirty poem. The Cummings poem called Etc. Or My Sweet Old Etc., rather. But you think it begins with the letter I? Anyone else?
Should it be an L?
Okay, so if it's an L, what do you get?
Oh.
L, a leaf falls, loneliness.
Yeah. So in the middle of what word?
Loneliness.
We find a parenthesis which says... Yeah. So the poem is essentially the word loneliness with a parenthesis between the opening L and the leaf falling. Why does he do it that way? Yeah.
To me, when I'm looking at it like structurally, all the words are like falling in like separate sections, and like that can also represent the loneliness that they're trying to like get across, because it's like a singular leaf separated from the rest of like its main branch plant. So it's like a lonely fall because like none of the other leaves go with it, and so it has to go alone.
Okay, lovely. So I think what you're saying also is that the poem is almost a picture of the falling leaf. Is that right? Okay, good. That's really good. Were you about to say something?
No, it's
no.
Fine.
Okay. So, yeah, a leaf falls. Not leaves fall. It would be very different if it were leaves fall. But a leaf falls. Loneliness. If you said this poem had a title, what would the title be? I know that's a weird question, but...
Probably Loneliness.
Yeah, I think it's got a pseudo title, which is the word loneliness, and then the poem itself, in a way, is A Leaf Falls. And it's as though you're taking the title and the leaf is falling as the poem is thinking of its own title and falling into the loneliness it describes. So no, technically not a title, but it's a way of thinking about what happens. Okay, so Massimo made a mistake in the first letter, which he read as, anyone remember?
I.
But it's actually the letter L. What else does it look like?
One.
Yeah.
One. So... anything else that picks up on that idea?
One.
Okay, yeah, the one.
Two, one. That's a stretch, never mind.
Wait, what?
There's like...
Oh, yeah, L's. So you mean in line five?
Yeah.
Okay, so two ones in line five. So you get... look at the first line. It's the letter L, which could be the numeral one. And remember I was telling you about how old typewriters worked?
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, in old typewriters, I think I mentioned this, but I'll repeat it. In old typewriters, you didn't have a separate numeral one. the numerals, which are on the top row of the typewriter, went from 2 through 9. You used a capital O for 0, and you used the letter L for 1. It still can be a problem on the internet, right? If you're not copying an address, if you're not cutting and pasting an address, or you're not pasting an address, but you're actually trying to type it out, we'll frequently type a 1 where, or type an L where we should be typing a 1, or vice versa. And I think, in fact, some phishing emails do that. That is, it'll look like it's a standard address, except there'll be an L where there's a 1. It's also leet speak, or are you all too young to know what leet speak is?
No, I know what you mean. Where you use like letters as numbers and symbols and stuff like that.
Right, exactly. So the name for that is leet speak, L-E-T-E, speak, yeah.
Was E.E. Cummings a lonely guy?
You might guess so.
Yeah, like, Et Cetera was also pretty sad.
Yeah.
So did he suffer after the war from like PTSD or something?
Probably, but also lots of people write poems when they're feeling lonely, and it doesn't mean that's the way they're feeling all the time. It just means that... what the sample of their lives that you're going to get is the lonely parts of their lives.
Yeah.
Shelley has a line in his poem called Julian and Madelow, where someone says to the narrator, most wretched men are cradled into poetry by wrong. Tell me when we get to the rhyme. Most wretched men are cradled into poetry by wrong. So tell me when we get to the rhyme. Most wretched, the onset rhyme. Most wretched men are cradled into poetry by wrong. All right, you guys are so good. They learn in suffering what they teach in song. So, yeah, it could be that. Okay, so we get the letter L, which is also on a typewriter, and Cummings is very much a poet of the typewriter. Typewriters are newish when he starts writing poetry. Anyone know when typewriters come into general use? This is not something you've spent lots of time researching.
40s?
No, they basically are available to consumers by the last quintile of the 19th century. But most people don't have them, you're right, until the teens and 20s. So back before then, people would turn in handwritten papers. Does that sound like fun?
No.
No.
No autocorrect.
Yeah, exactly. So he types the letter L, which is also the numeral 1. It's not just that it looks like the numeral 1, it is the numeral 1. Then what do you make of the open paren? You who have read body, what could it be half of? Yeah, which is a, all typewriters? A 0. So possibly, that might be overreading, but possibly isn't. And then you get a.
Yeah, I mean, it's a single, like, a something. It's a singular.
Yeah, it's another, it's a singular article. So think how different it would be if it were L, open paren, and then acorn falls. It has to be a leaf, or it has to be something beginning with a consonant, right? And then notice the L again. It's all these singlenesses in the poem. Ooh, or one, a leaf falls. The poem can't be perfect. But in a way, any poem can't be perfect, because what a perfect poem would be is a poem where every line rhymed its every word with the next line. So, I don't know. There you go, share you foe, or something like that. And that would also be kind of boring. But it's not that poems are perfect, it's that they hit their marks. So here, obviously, you don't want to go so far as to say E stands for what? See, now I'm asking you what would be wrong. But if you were saying the L stood for the number one, what could E stand for, mathematicians? E, the natural log. Yeah. So if you were being super clever, you would say, okay, E is the natural log, and this is kind of about a tree, so a tree would turn naturally into a log. But he was not thinking that. So you definitely get lots of ones. L as a one, a as a one, L again as a one, then E. So it pairs off maybe with the E, and then you get F and fa. So do you think that's intentional? AF, FA? Yeah, it's intentional AF. Right?
Maybe the pairings, like there's three just sets of pairings, and then there's that one lone A.
Nice. Yeah. So good. Yeah, I really like that. So LE, the L's got the E. AF and FA. You also get a pattern there, just so you know, because we'll talk about it again. None of you were in my Shakespeare class, right? When were you in it?
3 years ago.
Yeah, okay, I don't think we talked about this then. But maybe we did. It's a pattern called chiasmus. So, do you know what it is? You were nodding.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's like IAXXA.
Yeah. Yeah, so
it's when
things get flipped. So an example in Milton is, Milton says, though fallen on evil days though fallen. That is, you have the fallen on evil days, and then he repeats, on evil days though fallen. So chiasmus comes from the Greek letter chi, which is sort of olive-ish or X-ish, and it means there's a crisscross. So that's where the word comes from. It's something to notice. You will see it all the time as a rhetorical move. Make America great again. Again, make America great. That would be a really stupid chiasmus, but it is a chiasmus. So here you get that sort of AFFA, maybe a linkage. So a leaf fall, and then you get the two L's, which could be two possibilities, either two things that are coming together, unlike the opening L, or it could be even when two come together, it's still one and one. Hamlet says, a man's life is no more than to say one. That is, it's a nice idea to think that one and one make two, but it could be that they don't. That you get a one and then you try to combine it with another one, but all you're left with is one and then one. Not one plus one, but just one, one, one. Just a repetition of that to the last syllable of recorded time. So, a leaf falls, and then you get the S and the closed paren. And then you get what word?
One.
Right, and then you get what letter?
Yeah.
Which
could be a one.
Yeah, or L, which could be a one. L is how you did do it. And then you get... Yeah, or maybe it's oneness.
Sure.
Or I-ness, that is the loneliness, the loneliness of the lonely person.
Yeah.
I'm stuck in my own I-ness.
Also, it's not even full, you know what I mean? It's not like a fully, like, so lonely, it doesn't even have the beginning of it.
Right, good. Yeah. Okay, so what makes this a poem? The lines, if it were simply literally false onlyness, it's not a poem, or it's much less of a poem than the fact that here it is in 9 lines, right? So it's the 9 lines that the 4 words are divided into that make it a poem. It's visually a poem. It is audibly a poem too, since you can't really read it aloud, or it'd be hard to read it aloud if you were hearing, oh, I'm going to read E. Cummings aloud. La, la, files loneliness is not going to be that great a poem. But seeing it makes it a poem. So this is a visual poem. And by that, I don't mean that it's like a visual work of art. I don't know if you have what I handed out the first day, but remember Easter Wings, which looks like 2 sets of wings. That's a visual poem where it's a picture, a representational picture of the thing that it's about, the way the lines are laid out. But here, it's that the words are decomposing into elements of themselves. And it's as though those elements, they're just not joining up, which is part of the loneliness of the poem. So it's visual, but it's not like looking at a picture or an ideogram or something like that. It's visual in the sense that you are seeing words falling apart. You're not seeing a picture that you can make when you break the words up the way you do in that poem, Easter Wings. What you're seeing are words that you are reading, not words that you are looking at, but words that you are reading. And that's a crucial difference, the difference between looking at a word and reading it. This is a word that you're reading that's falling apart. And that's what thinking in terms of lines does. Okay, someone want to look at the second Cummings poem? This is the one that we started looking at on Thursday. So you can see this is a pairing with the first one. It's similar in some ways, but what's different about it? Can anyone make sense of it?
Yeah. It's harder.
Okay, it's definitely harder, but can you make sense of it?
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Okay. Black against white sky, choose which from dropped leaf a goes whirling.
Okay. So what's happening there? What makes it harder? What's happened? Why is it harder? Why does he make it harder?
It's easier than the other one.
Really? Okay, why?
I don't think there's more, like, it's clear where the words are. Like, in the first one, that first line is nonsense, kind of. It's like bird.
Okay.
Loneliness kind of confused me. I'm trying to make it loneliness. There was no... And there's no, like, open parentheses throughout this. Like, the parentheses are in their own
spot. What about the other punctuation, though? Why does it start with a bang? Are you supposed to do that?
No.
Does anyone know the T.S. Eliot poem, The Hollow Man? Yeah, say it louder. Yeah, so it's, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Typical T.S. Eliot, I'm so depressed, which shows I'm deep poem. But this poem may not end with a bang, but it definitely begins with a bang, right? So, bang! Black with the K in the next line. Against... with the T in the next line. Wit. T. So it turns out to be white. Sky. Question mark? trees which from dropped leaf a goes whirl-ng with a period before the last letter. So why is he doing that? First of all, is that good grammar? Black against white sky. Okay, that works, right? It's not a sentence, but it's a totally meaningful phrase. What does it look like? Oh, well, it's black against white sky. Trees, which from dropped leaf, goes whirling. So did something get garbled in transmission? Easy question, remember? Does this make perfect syntactic sense?
No.
No, okay, good, thank you. So how do you fix it to make it make syntactic sense? Can you? What's the first problem syntactically? Okay, so just hearing it. So let's skip the punctuation. You're quite right about that, but skipping the punctuation, we agree that black against white sky is fine. No one is going to say, that makes no sense. Okay, what's the next set of words?
Trees. So comma after drop?
Okay, forget the punctuation.
Trees which from drop.
Yeah.
It's like inverted.
Yeah, trees from wind.
Yeah, not wind. Trees which from dropped. Okay, so how would you... I don't think you should. Almost, but not quite.
From which a leaf dropped.
Okay. So, trees from which a leaf dropped...
Or dropped a leaf.
Yeah. So it can't be that the trees goes whirling, although the word go might make you think it could. In other words, it's only when you find out that it's not go but goes that you realize the subject of goes whirling can't be trees, so it has to be
a leaf.
All right, a leaf which dropped from trees goes whirling.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, maybe that's as good as we can get. Can anyone do better? Or, okay, so if that's a question mark, and there is a question mark there, right? Maybe that works. Maybe that's, actually, that might be perfect. Dropped from which tree? Question mark. So a leaf goes whirling, dropped from which tree? So dropped from which tree, what would that, why would you not be sure which tree it was dropped from? Say it again? Because it's whirling. Okay, I think that might be exactly right. Nice. So, what's happening is that the poem is imitating a leaf that is whirling as it falls from a tree. What's black against the white sky? Is it the tree or the leaf? Yeah, I think it has to be the leaf. And there it is, whirling. It goes whirling, and you don't know which tree it dropped from, but that's part of the way it's whirling. And of course, the words in the poem are doing what?
Whirling.
whirling. So again, this is a poem which is not quite a picture, but it is the reading equivalent of looking at a picture. So again, just to be clear on this, because this is, I think, an important distinction to make, and one that poets make a lot, and not only poets, perceptual psychologists make a lot, is there's a difference between reading and seeing. And a way that you can tell that, did anyone do, this is like a psych, I know it's not called Psych 101, Psych 1 experiment. This is actually what I did when I was going through orientation at college. But it's actually a really neat experiment, so some of you may know it, where you're given a sheet of paper with words printed in different colors, and all the words are names for colors. You've seen that? How many people have seen that? And then what you're asked to do is say the color of the words on the page. And what happens when you try to do that? Yeah, you say the word. So if you see the word red written in black, you're not going to say black. You say red. Because you're not saying what you're seeing, you're saying what you're reading. And seeing and reading are different things. If the words are given to you in an alphabet you don't know, like how many people know Cyrillic? Okay, so if you have a bunch of words given to you in Cyrillic, in different colors, and you're asked to say the color of the words, you're just going to say the color of the words. You're going to have no trouble with it. You have trouble with it if you can read the words. In fact, the CIA and the KGB use this in interrogations. When someone claims that they don't understand a language, if they're being interrogated, how can I be a spy? I don't know any Russian. Okay, tell us the colors of these words. And then the person reads it, can't stop herself from reading the colors because she actually does know Russian. And you can't pass that test. It's one of those tests that you can't pass if your knowledge is too good. So this is actually a very basic psychological thing that spy agencies use to try to figure out whether someone is telling the truth when they claim they don't know a language. If they don't know a language, they pass the test really easily. If they do know the language, they fail. Say again?
I was just thinking, my high school uses this every year for concussion tests.
Oh, really? To see whether people are reading or... And the score would drop how? If you were getting the colors right?
Well, I don't remember whether they wanted you to read the... I think it switched off. There were two parts. For part of you, had to read the word and for part of you, had to identify the color. And if you did it really badly, then compared to your other years,
okay, so, but I think what the cool thing about this is... did it ever happen to you, by the way, before I say what the cool thing about it is?
No.
Good. Yeah. Wait, I'm sorry, say it louder. So how do you do that? It's something that you can do for colorblindness also. There are things that colorblind people can see that non-colorblind people can't. Patterns that they can see that non-colorblind people can't. Which is another interesting thing. But going back to the concussion test, you can, I think if you've done the, anyone who's done the read the colors test or say the color of the words test, you can do it if you do it slowly. You have to think and check three times before you say blue when you're looking at the word green written in blue paint. So you just have to say, basically you have to do a kind of mental checklist. Am I looking at the color of the last letter? Because that's all I should look at, is the color of the last letter. And ignore the word. Just look at the last letter as a standalone. Look at the color of that letter. Is it green. No, it's not. It's blue. Okay, blue. And the point is that you can pass the test if you do it really slowly. But maybe if you have a concussion, you can pass the test much more quickly. So the problem would be if you do too well on the test, it means you have a concussion. You're supposed to say the color of the words, and you do, because you're having a whole lot of trouble reading the words. So that it's an interesting reversal of what usually happens in tests. Okay, so something maybe like that is what the difference between seeing and reading is. And so for visual poetry, printed poetry, seeing is less part of the experience, even for printed poetry, than reading is, especially when reading is put under pressure. So, you know, if you look, for example, at the second to last line of the first poem, where you just get the L standing alone, that might be something you're seeing rather than reading. That is, it's the loneliness of the letter. Yes, it's the letter that stands for the numeral one, but it's also the loneliness of the letter. Or go back to body. Can you see, says Merrill, how like a little cold-rimmed moon O plots her course from B to D. But there again, you want to read the word body, and he's saying, don't read it, see it. And there's again this kind of tension between reading and seeing. One of the things that we see, the most important thing that we see when reading poetry are line endings. That edge, the right-hand edge. The left-hand edge can matter, but it's the right-hand edge that really matters. That's one of the things that we are seeing when we read poetry, and we are reading what is framed by something that we see. So there again, the line ending, it's like a borderline experience. There it is. Okay, anyone know where this line is from? Speaking of A Leaf Goes Whirling? These are but wild and whirling words. Hamlet. That's what Horatio says to Hamlet when Hamlet says, here's what the ghost told me. There's never a villain in all of Denmark, but he's an arrant knave. In other words, villains are villains. And Horatio says, what is wrong with you? These are but wild and whirling words. So at some point, Cummings just liked the idea of wild and whirling words and thought of that somehow as what poetry was. Okay, let us go back to the handout from a couple of days ago. And let's see, we have 10 minutes left. The last two poems are a poem called We Are Seven by William Wordsworth, and then a poem called We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks. You know that one. A lot of people know that one. Gwendolyn Brooks is almost certainly thinking of Wordsworth in her poem. Let's just for a minute look at We Real Cool. We'll return to it.
Did she create the golden shovel? Or
no?
Sorry? Did she create the idea?
No, someone. So define a golden shovel.
It's when you use the same word at the end of a line, and that's kind of like your base for the poem. Like We Real Cool, We Less Cool, We.
Yeah, but in fact, the guy, I forget his name, but the guy who invented the form, it's not the same word. It's you get like a sentence from the last words of a line. So the golden shovel form is an interesting one, sort of like an acrostic, but with words at the end of the line that themselves make up a sentence.
Oh, like if you line up the...
The last words.
Okay, that's what I thought it was too, but...
Yeah. But he named it after this poem. So the golden shovel would be a pool hole, bar and pool hole. And the poem is called We Real Cool. But the setting is the pool players 7 at the Golden Shovel. So 7 what?
7 pool players.
Yeah. Could be 7 p.m.
Yeah, because there's a period after pool players.
Yeah. But everyone takes it to be 7 pool players. You're sure it's 7. How come?
I'm not sure.
I mean, you're sure it's pool players.
I'm not positive.
I know, but why do you have that intuition? A lot of what we're doing is just figuring out why we have the intuitions that we do.
Because she's like, you could be like, oh, like, with the pool players. Oh, how many? Where are they?
Yeah.
7 at the Golden Shovel.
Yeah. Or remember Ambrose Bierce's definition of the letter I? The plural of I is said to be we. Although how there can be more than 2 myselves is difficult, but fine. The idea that there can be more than, that there can be another myself is difficult, but fine. Yeah, so you have a plural word, 7, and then you have a plural pronoun. Someone want to read it aloud? Go, Craig.
The pool players, 7 at the Golden Shovels. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Okay, so anyone who had heard Craig read that, where would you put the line endings?
Before the we.
Yeah, you would hear it as we real cool, line ending. We left school, line ending. Has anyone seen, there's a YouTube of Gwendolyn Brooks reading this aloud. Has anyone seen it? Can you describe it?
It was like 4 years ago.
Okay, at least it wasn't 7 years ago. 7 years ago at the Golden Shovel. She definitely does not pause at the punctuation marks. I'll try and find a YouTube and send it, but she does it as... essentially, we real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. So obviously she does it a lot better than that, but that's essentially the way she does it. So why do you think she's ending the line with repetitive words rather than with the rhyme? Yeah.
It places emphasis on like the die soon as the last line because it's different than the rest, but if she had started them all with the we, it just kind of like blend in.
Yeah. So most people remember this. Just, you know, ask your roommate or ask someone who hasn't read this recently what it looks like on the page. Just ask the first person you see on the street. And they'll remember it as we real cool, line ending. We left school, line ending. We lurk late, etc. But it very much doesn't. And the way she reads it aloud, you can probably hear that the we's are line endings. But if you were to read it the way you're instructed to read it in school, which is if you haven't left school but are reading it the way you're instructed to read it in school, you don't pause at an enjambment, right? But you do pause at punctuation. So aloud, it's going to sound the way Craig just read it. We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon. And you would just hear it as a series of couplets, every line beginning with the pronoun we. But the reason she doesn't, say it again.
Is so there's emphasis on the last line.
Yeah. So what happens at the end of the poem? What word don't we get?
We.
Why not? What's happened to us? We're dead. Say it again?
I just said it's on emphasis.
Yeah. But there's no we left. It's an example. It's a parable of what happens, which is the we disappears. Why? Because we die soon. And in the poem, when does that happen? It happens as soon as the poem ends, on the word soon. So here the line endings really matter. The interplay of line endings with rhyme really matters. And you could partly say one of the questions is, who's in control of the rhyme? That is, think about a ballad, because ultimately this poem is an allusion. It goes back to ballads. But think about, well, let's look at Proud Maisie again, which we didn't really get a chance to look at. So the first sheet of this. Proud Maisie is in the wood, walking so early. Sweet Robin sits on the bush, singing so rarely. Tell me, thou bonny bird, when shall I marry me? So she offers the onset rhyme. Remember, we were talking about dialogue in ballads and rhyme. Tell me, thou bonny bird, when shall I marry me? And the robin responds, when six broad gentlemen kirkward shall carry ye. So she offers the onset. She's in control, let's say, of the rhyme. But the bird of ill omen, kind of the albatross of this poem, takes her marry me and turns it into the opposite, when you will be carried to the graveyard in the church. Who makes the bridal bed? Birdie, say truly. Again, she wants to control the rhyme, but the bird answers, the gray-headed sexton that delves the grave duly. So the bridal bed is a grave. And then the bird goes on, the glowworm or graven stone shall light thee steady. The owl from the steeple sing, welcome, proud lady. So she loses control of the rhymes. Why? Because she dies. She will die in her pride. In her wrongness, she will die. So in a way, We Real Cool is doing the same thing. Look what they're doing. They are alliterating and rhyming. We Real Cool. We left school. That's how cool we are. We lurk late. Alliteration, someone define it. Yeah, a bunch of the same letters, an unusually large bunch of the same consonants. So lurk late, and then alliteration again. We strike straight. What's the alliteration in the second two words?
S-T-R.
Strike straight. We sing sin, alliteration again, and rhyme. We thin gin. What does thin gin mean, do you think?
Take it down. I drink it.
Probably not. They don't have much money. So what do they have to... They water it down. Yeah. So, we jazz June. Alliteration. What do you think that means?
Like, make someone angry? Like, jazz them up?
Yeah, or just make it all at least frenetic. Not necessarily angry, but, you know, you could jazz something up, meaning to energize it. We die soon. So remember we talked about the D sound in the J sound? Jazz, June, die soon. It's like the alliteration turns into... just the die. But they think they're in control of the rhyme and the alliteration and the poetic qualities. But the poem as in Proud Maisie, at the end says, no, not so much. We die soon. And then there's no we after that. Okay, bring this in again on Thursday.